I want to thank the New Criterion for having this conference and all of you for your endurance this morning and for coming out. As some people have mentioned, I just wrote this book, JFK Conservative, which is out now and which I hope you all buy outside. It's getting some nice reviews in the and some not so nice reviews. Jim Pearson in the National Review has a review out that calls it excellent. The Weekly Standard has a review out by Ronald Radosh, which calls it compelling. And the New Yorker described it as loony. So we're going to have a vote at the end of the talk, which side you come down on.
We've all had that experience.
So a lot of the reviews of this book say things like, Stoll argues that JFK was a conservative, or Stoll makes the case that JFK was a conservative. And it's true, I do argue in this book that both by the standards of our time and his time, John Kennedy was a conservative who cut taxes and tariffs, restrained domestic spending, wanted to reform welfare, and built up the military in pursuit of a Cold War advantage against what he considered the godless Soviet Union. But I'm not just being modest when I say that I think the strongest arguments in this book for Kennedy's conservatism come not from me, but from Kennedy himself. They're Kennedy's words, not mine, and he was probably a better writer than I am anyway, so let's hear some of them. The book begins with congressional candidate Kennedy's July 4th, 1946 speech, in which he spoke of the right of the individual against the state and, quote, Christian morality, end quote. He said America's basic religious ideas were being challenged at home in the cynical philosophy of many of our intellectuals, abroad in the doctrine of collectivism. That sounds like something you might read in the New Criterion. Congressman Kennedy's 1950 speech at Notre Dame, in which he warned, quote, the ever-expanding power of the federal government, the absorption of many of the functions that states and cities once considered to be the responsibilities of their own, must now be a source of concern to all those who believe, as did the Irish patriot Henry Grattan, control over local affairs is the essence of liberty. There was Senator Kennedy's 1955 speech at Assumption College in my hometown of Worcester, Massachusetts, where he said about the Cold War, I believe religion itself is at the root of the struggle, not in terms of the physical organizations of Christianity versus those of atheism, but in terms of good versus evil, right versus wrong. And his remarks during the 1960 campaign at the Mormon Tabernacle in Salt Lake City, where he said, the enemy is the communist system itself, implacable, insatiable, unceasing in its drive for world domination. It's also a struggle for supremacy between two conflicting ideologies, freedom under God versus ruthless, godless tyranny. Or even Kennedy's famous lines in the inaugural address. The same revolutionary beliefs for which our forefathers fought are still at issue around the globe. The belief that the rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God. We shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe to assure the survival and success of liberty, or as Kennedy said, liberty. ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. I mean, we've gone from ask not what your country can do for you to the world of Obama phones, Obamacare, and food stamps. Or President Kennedy's speech about tax cuts to the New York Economic Club in December of 1962, where he said, our true choice is not between tax reduction on the one hand and the avoidance of large federal deficits on the other. In short, it's a paradoxical truth that tax rates are too high today and tax revenues are too low, and the soundest way to raise the revenues in the long run is to cut the rates now. The purpose of cutting taxes now is not to incur a budget deficit, but to achieve the more prosperous, expanding economy, which can bring a budget surplus. Okay, you can say that's just rhetoric. What about actions? Well, the tax cut did pass. It passed the House in September of 1963 and the Senate after Kennedy's death, and it became law. Kennedy did sharply increase military spending while maintaining restraint on domestic spending, and he and his successors did also cut tariffs on imports using the trade negotiating authority Kennedy won from Congress. He escalated the war in Vietnam, and he stood down the Soviets in Berlin and in Cuba. He appointed a Supreme Court Justice, Byron White, who wrote the dissent in the abortion case Roe v. Wade. Now, people may ask, why should we care whether Kennedy was a conservative beyond the usual partisan motives of claiming a popular figure for our side? After all, he's been dead for 50 years. The Soviet Union is gone. Tax rates now are a lot lower than they were during the Eisenhower-Nixon administration, when the top marginal rate was 91%. Well, I do think that many of the issues Kennedy dealt with, economic growth, immigration, free trade, a sound dollar, peace through strength, are still with us today, and that his policies can be a guide. But I also want to address in some detail this issue of the tax cut, because in the reaction from liberals to this book, and it's not just the New Yorker sneering loony, but the online magazine Salon, which called this book the right's favorite new lie, and even the sometimes sensible Economist, which called the argument ridiculous in a blog post by a writer who later admitted on Twitter that he hadn't even bothered to read the book. What seems to anger the left most of all is my suggestion that President Kennedy was a supply-side tax cutter whose pro-growth tax cuts were the forerunner of President Reagan's and George W. Bush's. Nonsense, these modern liberals say. The Kennedy tax cuts, they insist, were Keynesian efforts to stimulate demand by increasing the budget deficit and putting money in the hands of poor people who would spend it and stimulate the economy. And anyway, the rate Kennedy was cutting from, that 91%, was far more than either the pre-Reagan or pre-Bush levels. The evidence I uncovered in researching my book demolishes these claims. One of the most prominent Keynesian economists in the Kennedy administration, John Kenneth Galbraith, who, Fred, I'm sorry you left him out of your book, because maybe there's a Kindle single in just debunking of Galbraith, because there's a lot to be said there, opposed Kennedy's tax cut. Galbraith opposed Kennedy's tax cut. That got that? The leading Keynesian, John Kenneth Galbraith, opposed the Kennedy tax cut, preferring increased government spending instead. As usual, I would be against a tax cut, Galbraith wrote to Kennedy in May 1962. And you know, lest anyone accuse me of fabricating that quote, you could go by that from Harvard University Press, the collected letters of John Kenneth Galbraith, published while Galbraith, I believe, was still alive, in which this letter appears. Apparently unabashedly. Then there's an oral history I found at the JFK Library, which records that after a meeting with JFK in 1963, actually, Kennedy thought so little of Galbraith's economics that he appointed him to the key economic policy-making role of ambassador to India. But Galbraith used to fly back from India to kibitz, and actually got into the White House to meet with JFK. The rival economists within the administration joked that they needed to establish a Galbraith early warning system to warn them of approaches of Galbraith. But finally, after a meeting with JFK in 1963, Galbraith slumped dejected into the White House mess and told his internal rivals, "You've won. The president told me to shut up about my opposition to tax cuts." Another Keynesian economist in the Kennedy administration, James Tobin of Yale, also wanted to increase spending and the budget deficit. Kennedy said no, and Tobin complained about it telling an interviewer that Kennedy showed himself very much scared of the financial conservatives in Congress and a good deal more conservative himself and less sophisticated than I had expected. Among the other economists within the administration who did favor a tax cut, some of them, like Paul Samuelson and Robert Salo, wanted a quickie temporary tax cut, or even standby tax-cutting authority for the president, so that the president could adjust the tax rate like a radio dial, depending on economic statistics or forecasts. Kennedy rejected those ideas, telling Congressman Wilbur Mills about in a taped conversation about economists such as Samuelson and Salo, "I don't have any confidence in these fellows. They can't tell. They can't tell." And that was after the Council of Economic Advisors had actually blown an economic forecast that kind of embarrassed the president. So he was ticked off at these guys, and he didn't buy the idea that some group of PhD economists could, in a kind of central planning fashion, temporarily adjust the tax rates, even though they were arguing for legislation that would give them the power to do just that. Far from embracing the Kennedy tax cuts, a number of liberals at the time denounced them. Senator Albert Gore Sr., Democrat of Tennessee, called it a bonanza for fat cats. Sound familiar? The AFL-CIO wanted to restructure Kennedy's proposed rate cuts so that more benefits went to lower income earners who would be more likely to spend the proceeds. But Kennedy was adamant, telling the New York Economic Club that the tax cuts should be both for those in the lower brackets who would spend the extra money and for those in the upper and middle brackets, this is a quote, "for those in the middle and upper brackets who can thereby be encouraged to undertake additional efforts and enabled to invest more capital." This point was also made by the chairman of Kennedy's Council of Economic Advisors, Walter Heller, in testimony to Congress in January 1963. A Democratic senator had asked why the tax cut was preferable to a deficit achieved by increased government spending, which this senator argued, would provide a greater multiplier effect. It sounds familiar from the debates over the Obama stimulus. Quote, "it isn't the deficit we seek," Heller replied, explaining that tax cuts had a certain, quote, "effect on incentives that spending did not have." Finally, the liberals who obsessed about the 91% Eisenhower top income tax rate that Kennedy wanted to bring down to 65% conveniently forget the 25% capital gains rate, which then is now applied to much income earned by the rich. Kennedy wanted to bring that down to 19.5%, lower than the top 23.8% that applies to long-term capital gains today. If the Kennedy plan was just a crude effort to get more money into the hands of poor people who would spend it, then why did he want to cut the capital gains tax rate, which the left says now is just a tax paid by rich people who own stock or businesses or houses? The economic advisor who probably had more to do with the Kennedy tax cut than any of these Keynesian Ivy League economists was Douglas Dillon, Kennedy's Treasury Secretary. He was a Republican Wall Street banker who had actually donated $26,000 with his wife to the Nixon campaign. And when Kennedy announced plans to make him Treasury Secretary, Albert Gore Sr. was so upset about it that he went and met with Kennedy for the express purpose of talking Kennedy out of the appointment. And Dillon was interviewed afterward and said that the Kennedy tax cut was just the first of what he hoped would be a series of additional tax cuts, especially if the Cold War ever ended. He thought there would be room to bring the rates down even lower. If Kennedy was trying to stimulate the economy through a temporary increase in the federal deficit, as this left-wing claim is, he failed. Federal tax receipts increased in both absolute and real terms in 1964, 1965, and 1966 as compared to 1963, which was the last year that the old Eisenhower-Nixon rates were in effect. And not only Walter Heller in that congressional testimony, but even Kennedy in that New York Economic Club speech had denied that a larger deficit was the goal. So to argue that Kennedy's goal was to increase the budget deficit with his tax cuts is to argue that both the president and Heller lied about the policy, and then that the policy was a failure because the revenues actually went up. My argument is that Kennedy was telling the truth and that the policy was a success. One person who well understood that was Ronald Reagan, who in July 1982 called his own tax cut the first decent tax program since John Kennedy's tax cut nearly 20 years ago, and who repeatedly cited Kennedy as an example on both economic and foreign policy. Later, in the 1984 campaign, Reagan said that whenever he talked about Kennedy, "My opponents start tearing their hair out. They just can't stand it." Well, of course they can't, because it highlights how far they, the leadership of the Democratic Party, have strayed. Alas, to judge by the reaction to my book on the left, Reagan's words are as true today as they were then. Now, I have thick skin and didn't much expect liberals to like my book anyway. But the point is important, because if we're to learn from Kennedy's experience in bringing about economic growth through tax cuts, in achieving peace through strength, in all these other ways that, like Reagan, he managed an optimistic outlook that made Americans feel confident in their country and proud to be Americans. If we're to learn from that, then I think we need to pierce this this myth that, as Jim was talking about, was established by Reston in part and by Theodore White in part, and I make the case by Ted Sorensen and Arthur Schlesinger Jr. Another one, like Galbraith, who Kennedy had a sort of low opinion on. I mean, I quote Evelyn Lincoln, Kennedy's secretary, as saying that Kennedy knew very well that Schlesinger would rather be serving in a Stevenson administration, and that his goal was really to advance Schlesinger's own liberal goals, not Kennedy's goals. So anyway, if we're to learn from the Kennedy experience on all those points, the way I think Reagan did, then we need to break through these myths and get back and understand the facts, the real Kennedy, as he was. So that's what I try to do in my book, and I'm glad to have the chance to talk about it here this morning. I'm looking forward to making it more of a interactive discussion in the next period here.
Thank you, Ara.